Welcome to Fresno's Best Podcast. I'm your host, Jordan Maddox. Today, we have Dr. Harmon Virk on the show. Dr. Virk is a board-certified internal medicine physician that grew up in Fresno and is now one of the owners of the new medical clinic called the Modern Medicine Group. He hopes to offer a deeper understanding of the unique healthcare challenges faced by residents living in Fresno. He is committed to promoting preventative care and is excited to discuss his compassionate and patient-centered approach to medicine and is eager to continue to make a difference in the lives of his patients through his continuous work with his medical clinic. We talk about so much in this podcast, including trends in healthcare, the rise of influencers and gurus in social media giving medical advice, endemic and environmental issues in Fresno and how we address those, and much more. Let's go meet Dr. Virk, and Baker will take us there. To elevate guests, politics, religion, culture, art, music, show some respect to the best little city left in the U.S. Fresno's best. Fresno's best. Where do you like to eat in Fresno?
I really like home cooked meals, man. I'm gonna be 100% honest with you. But I mean, growing up in Fresno, there's a few nice restaurants. I mean, like Cezanne's the new place, right? Teen Prime. But I mean, being here for like 25 plus years though, Jordan, like you'll start to see that there's a huge change in even just the restaurant business, like fast casual. I think Fresno Central Valley ideally likes fast casual dining. There's really not too many places where we like to go and sit and have a fine dining experience. Things like Heirloom, right? Like that's another common spot, but their whole concept's farm to table, you know, and then casual, like fast casual dining. But yeah, I mean, I like Cezanne. I like the hole in the wall Mexican taqueria spots, like better out in the kind of the boonies a little bit.
What's your Cezanne order? What are the kinds of things? Are you a big fish person?
I like fish. Yeah, I like fish. I like they do these really nice like tostadas that are like tuna tostadas, I think. Like avocado and stuff, and it's not super heavy, but it's like just right. It's filling. That's my probably like that. And like they do these really good goat chops or lamb chops. They're lamb chops.
Ooh, I haven't had those before. Yeah, it's so hard because that place, the reservations just fill up so fast. And then you have to make that choice. Do I want to sit on the patio when it's 98 degrees? In order to get the food that I want. And I wrestle with this because it is a trade-off there. But yeah, I love their food too. That's where my wife fell in love with grilled oysters. Yeah, they have such a variety of things. And she's not really a fish person, but she loves that place. So I think that's a sign that they're doing something well if you can convince a non-fish-focused person to eat at your establishment. So Is there something that you order at a taqueria that's your preference? So what's your go-to taqueria order?
I just like taco. Like I like the crispy shell tacos. If I could find one good spot, I still haven't found a really great spot that does just the crispy tacos, you know, the crunchy tacos.
Yeah.
And like maybe their house salsa or something and maybe a beer or two. That's like the perfect order, I think. That's obviously not every day. That sounds like a once a month treat myself type of thing.
Yeah, you've had a long week. It's a Friday afternoon and you're just like, all right, I'm just going to go settle in a taqueria. For sure.
Exactly. No, exactly.
Well, it's ironic that we're talking about that because we're going to jump to talking about health and wellness and medicine now.
Exactly.
We'll pivot hard from fried food. So I've got a bunch of questions I want to ask you related to kind of medical training and changes in the field to start.
100%.
Do you think nutrition and exercise are the most important topics that are not extensively covered in medical school?
I think, I think that the training with us like physicians, right? Obviously, I think the big cornerstone of a lot of our chronic illnesses, diabetes, hypertension, COPD, a lot of it's lifestyle mediated. But we also have to look at that previous generation that was like 50, 60 years older than us, right? In the 1950s, 1960s, 1970s, I mean, smoking was a big social thing, right? But now we know all the devastating effects that come from smoking and the certain lifestyle factors that people were indulging at that time. Obviously, I think there's also been a big, huge shift in terms of food quality, processed foods. You go to any grocery store, you're going to see on the ingredient label. I mean, the average person probably doesn't even know what's in half the stuff that they're eating. You know what I mean? But to answer your question, yeah, I think that we did, at least at my medical school, we did get a good, decent amount of nutrition training. And then prior to actually myself, when I went into medicine, I had a background a little bit about a year or so when I was in college. My major was focused in nutrition science at one point. But then it kind of delves into the more like the big corporate nutrition, like industries that there are in terms of like processing and microscopically like looking at food and how these big factories, and then it turns into a little bit more of like ingredient sourcing and the whole capitalist type of component to it, the business aspect of it. So I changed tune really quick because I realized like when it comes to nutrition education, I'll get a little bit more of it. And I think that a lot of it also comes down to just what we put into our bodies. But I think that most of what we deal with is lifestyle mediated. And from my perspective, the things like diabetes, the things like hypertension, the things like liver disease, yeah, a lot of it's kind of a compounded multifactorial approach there. It's not just diet. It's also stress. It's also alcohol. You can have a great diet, but there's people out here who are, they have a great diet Monday through Friday, and then weekends they're pounding 15, 20 drinks. And
yeah, that doesn't add up, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. The way I look at it is 80-20. 80% of the time I want to be well-behaved and 20% I want to live my life.
100%.
But there are some choices that can have multiplier effects. Obviously, if you just have a burger a week, it's different than having a couple cigarettes a day versus a pack a day or 100%. Something. And so there's things that can be forced multipliers for your health. Speaking of that, how much better would our delivery of medical services be if medical students, residents, and doctors got better sleep?
Oh, gosh. I think they did a study about this, about like sleep deprivation. And they found that, quite frankly, when it comes to our training, there's just so much that we have to jam pack in so little time. You have your 4 years of undergrad, sure, but then you do your 4 years of medical school, right? In medical school, just the sheer amount of volume that we have to learn today compared to what doctors needed to know 30, 40 years ago, it's probably at least 5 to 7 times more, at least. And when it comes to residency training, now we do have an hourly cap where we're not technically allowed to work more than 80 hours a week on average. But I'm going to be 100% honest with you, and I hope there's no administrators from our previous hospital, but there were regular times where we would be clocking in 112, 115 hours per week because that's just what the job entailed. Like, sure, maybe my shift was 7 a.m. to 7 p.m., but I'm at the hospital 4:35 reading up on everything, checking in with patients, doing my pre-rounds, and then doing all that, and then education, and then meetings. So, I mean, to answer your question, Jordan, I would say that there may be a change. I think now it is definitely a lot better because we are focused on wellness initiatives in residency now, because there weren't that many documented and advertised like resident suicides. That was a thing at one point. And so mental health is in general just been played a huge part now. I think just throughout any industry, not just medical. I mean, I think if you talk to anybody working and even in finance or something, there's always more work to get done, right? Mm-hmm.
If you were to poll the average physician,
yeah,
maybe recently out of medical or recently finishing their residency, and you ask them to explain what a p-value is, what percentage could do it accurately?
Accurately, probably a good maybe 80%. We do get some basic statistics training.
Okay.
Very basic though. But there's some of us that are heavy into the research side. I myself am not. For my instance, like our biggest thing is like p-value less than like 0.05 or whatever. What was a significant p-value, right?
Yeah.
But for our purposes, especially I think community clinicians, we're not as research heavy. There are some of us who conduct studies. We had to do research studies throughout medical school, but that would be a better thing for the academics out there. The ones who are like Stanford and Loma Linda, and they have that brand name.
Yeah.
Type of approach there. Because there are doctors who just do academic medicine. They don't really do community-based medicine anymore.
Well, and I the reason I'm asking that or broaching that subject is that there's been a lot since COVID and before, people doing their own research to understand and make medical decisions. And sometimes can be the conduits from an article that's in the New England Journal of Medicine And then someone went on Google Scholar and looked it up and tried to assess it for themselves.
Yeah.
My question always to them is, can you explain the methodology to me? And if they can do that, then I'm going to keep listening. But if they can't, then I'm going to stop.
Exactly.
But at the same time, you're trying to balance empowering people to care and make good decisions about their health. But at the 100%. Same time, a lot of people think they're understanding what they're reading, but they might not be. So how do you talk with patients about doing their own research about their health?
I always tell patients this, that especially now in the world, like social media, like you can go and on your feed, there will be a 30-second clip of somebody. We don't know what their credentials are, right? We don't know what their credibility is. And they may just take a blurb from some sort of abstract or conclusion, just be like, oh yeah, this study's great. But like you're saying, it's not just the results. There's things like bias, confounding factors that do go into, that can manipulate these certain studies, right? So instance, when residency, we used to partake in these things called journal clubs, where we would break down what we would refer to as like landmark trials in our field. Like how come one anticoagulant is better than another? Or when should we do a certain type of targeted temperature management in stroke patients? Things like this. These things have been studied, right? And that's the beauty about medicine, is it constantly evolves. There's times where there's studies in the past that have been refuted now because A, we know more about the disease process, right? B, there's more of a sample population and a sample size, which increases your power, right, of that actual study and what you're trying to find. And then how to limit those confounding factors too, right? But I always tell patients, like, when it comes to doing your own research, you also comes with the understanding that the average American, I think there was some interesting thing about their reading level being at like the fifth grade reading level, right? And so it's like, how do you take kind of like college level material and methodology and results and discussing credibility and p-values and statistics and certain equations, right? And how do you simplify that down to feed it to someone who may have a fifth, sixth, seventh grade reading level? Do you know what I mean? That's where I think the hardest part comes down to. And we live in a fast food society, meaning that we want everything fast. We don't want to sit down and go through the studies. We want to just, what's the result? What do I need to do?
Yeah.
And
when people bring this up to me, I encourage them to look at meta-analyses or like
100%.
Or like summary documents that take that not, they don't collate, but they take kind of the broad strokes of the major research that's been done and try to draw some cautious conclusions. That's where I tend to refer. Let me give you another example. So there, for whatever reason, this must just be my online activity. I get fed a lot of health and wellness stuff when I get onto YouTube. And there's this guy that popped up on my feed a while ago, and I don't think he's practicing at the moment, but he was a board certified psychiatrist. And then it looks like he made some money in crypto and moved to Costa Rica. And now he's giving people nutrition advice on YouTube. And he has one video where he kind of like justifies himself, like giving advice about what to eat. And for the record, his advice is basically to eat steak and like organic fruit all day. And he was like, I learned the basics of how to analyze and understand research. And even though I'm a psychiatrist and that's where most of my training is, I feel comfortable enough doing my own research and then sharing that with the broader public. What do you think about a character like that?
I think that I know exactly who the doctor is that you're talking about, too, because I've seen some of their material, too. Right. I always think like this, like, yes, you're a psychiatrist and that's your realm, right? Your realm, your specialty, your bread and butter is knowing the human psyche, the mind, psychiatric and mental illness, right? I think that it shouldn't be one of those things where, oh, I know that this is the perfect diet. Like, it doesn't really work for everybody. I think everyone has an individualistic approach. In my opinion, I always tell patients this. I believe in logic and kind of common sense for the most part, which common sense isn't common, right? That's a very common saying.
Yeah.
I always think like this. If you look at the concept of agriculture, you look at the concept of how food, when we went from hunting and gathering to an actual sense of farming our own food, making our own food, and then factory accommodation of the food. Quite frankly, I think it's not a one size fits all answer that, oh yeah, eat steak all day and your blood pressure will go away. I think that there's a limitation and moderation is the key to anything. Now, I'm not saying that you should stay away from steaks and that people should just ingest sugar all day and it's more natural. I always genuinely believe that, in my opinion, a majority of a lot of these fitness researcher, nutritionist guys, obviously everyone's in a clickbait. We're in a clickbait environment now, right? Yeah. And so my thing is calories in, calories out. That's the personal approach I take with a lot of patients that do get somewhat good results. Now there's a whole semi-glutide craze and this weight loss drugs and weight loss, this and that. Oh, I need 10 pounds lost. Let me put this. I genuinely don't believe people need that. I think people just generally need willpower. And I generally think that people need to just watch what they're consuming. And physics is all thermodynamics, right? It's, your body is a set sort of energy. You have a basic metabolic index of how much muscle activity you need and how much muscle mass you have, how much activity you need. A football player who's 250 pounds, 6'4", they're going to need 3,000 calories probably to maintain their physique, right? Whereas someone who's not as active, they're probably going to need a little bit less. So to answer your question, I don't think it's a one size fits all, but for that specific doctor, I mean, if it helps certain people, there's probably certain people who probably get results from it. But quite frankly, what I think that those people who are getting those results, all they did was they switched from eating crap to eating quote unquote whole foods, which I don't know what that term is. I mean, food is food. Now, when food's not processed, yes, and you're having the steak from the grocery market or from the butcher or whatever, I'm sure there's certain ways of how they prep it and things like that, right? I will never know the details of all that, but I always tell patients that things like MyFitnessPal, things like these calorie trackers, if someone can genuinely track everything that they put into their mouth, no matter how much, and actually weigh it, that's the only way that you're going to tell. But most people are not going to go through the nitty gritty of that. You know what I mean?
It feels like a lot of it is like, oh, if you eat these certain things, you can eat as much as you want. And that was that's I don't know if I want to call it a like mythology that's been created, but I think people are just, like you said, they want things fast. And if there's like a faster way to get X, that's just not laborious taxing of just like literally going through and managing like what you're intaking each day. 100%. There's another kind of a medical guru that's in vogue right now. His name is Peter Attia, and he just put out a book this year called Outlive. That was last year. Last year, Outlive. And one of the things he talks about is that medicine is moving from a 2.0 to a 3.0 culture in the sense that we're focused less now about just kind of emergency room. How can we fix the problem once it's already there? But how do we prevent the problem?
Right.
And that seems obviously like the direction we need to go with medicine. But I guess my question is, do you think, not to be morbid, but do you think we're going to have a generational change in terms of who our physicians are, their backgrounds, before we can make that change in medicine more broadly? In other words, there's a group of people that were trained under a different regime, a different philosophy around medicine. Okay. And those people are still largely at the top of our hospitals and our different medical.
Right.
Do you think those people are going to make the change, or is it going to we're going to have to wait until we get a new generation of doctors that are taking over the leadership reins?
That's a good question. I think we do have a new generation of doctors that are coming in, but it's all about developing your niche, I think, because at the end of the day, patients now, they have so much more access to information and knowledge, where most of my job I feel is now really spent teaching and counseling rather than changing things, unless I'm fixing someone else's mistake, which is with my new practice. Like, that's where I'm really finding a lot. I'm finding that there's a lot of mistreatment and misdiagnosis and mismanagement of actually common illnesses that we should know how to treat. Now, does that come down to training? Does that come down to your experience, clinical experiences, how much you've delved into the pathophysiology and research and science? Because at the end of the day, that's the one thing about science, right? And kind of bear with me. I'm gonna take a little bit of a turn in terms of your answer. Science is, the beautiful thing about science is it starts off as a hypothetical thing, right? We run these certain studies, we go through the scientific method, and we have concrete clinical evidence or research and numbers that doesn't really give us a definite yes or no, this is beneficial, but it gives us this is most likely really beneficial. But I think our generation of doctors has changed more to more of a, any medication we prescribe, anything that we do is more of a shared decision-making process. It's not as simple as, oh, your A1C is a 10, you're going to be on insulin. No, like, is that probably more medically indicated? Yeah, but I always like to talk to patients first. Like, hey, look, this is what your numbers are. This is option A, option B, option C. How do you want to play it? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so I think the newer generation now is we're starting to take our patients' preferences into actual decision making, rather than just being like, you need this medication and take this. If you don't, good luck. You know
Yeah,
what I mean?
let me jump in and ask you a follow-up to that.
Yeah.
One of the things continuing with Atiyah's work is that he really encourages people to be difficult patients if they have a more
Yeah.
traditional doctor. Do you
Yeah.
think that's the best approach if your physician is maybe not doesn't have the same goals, or should you just seek out a new physician that's more aligned with your goals?
Sure. I think it comes down to what you're just saying. It comes down to what are your goals, right? It comes down to seeking a physician A that's gonna listen to what you have to say, right? But it's also that understanding that there's we run through it here time to time. Patients come in and they know that I have such, right? Because of what I read on Google or WebMD. I need this medication. And I always tell them, that's not usually how it works. That's not fast food medicine. I don't practice fast food medicine. I don't practice, oh, I need Xanax and I need this and I need no, we don't do that. But I do encourage patients to ask questions. I do encourage patients to share their viewpoint because they're the one that's been living with the illness most likely for many years, right? And I encourage patients to know what they're taking, why they're taking, what they're taking, and how much they're taking. And is there a plan to get you off of this medication? Or was there a plan just to keep you on this medication forever and reassess? That's a big thing too. And so quite frankly, more often than not, I'm finding myself actually taking patients off of medications that they probably should have been off of, 5, 10, 15 years ago. But that's like you were saying earlier, it's an older generation of doctors where they're not really concerned as much about the follow-up. And quite frankly, you can't just blame physicians too. I mean, medicine has become more corporatized now, where it's like we have other clinicians or healthcare providers now, right, that don't have as much clinical training and experience as like board certified physicians do. And it's like very easy for someone to just prescribe something. And yeah, it's changing. But I always encourage patients ask the right questions. It's sometimes that's half the battle too, is knowing what to ask, you
Exactly,
know?
exactly.
And so yeah, it's very hit or miss.
How often should a healthy person do blood work?
If you're healthy once a year,
Once a
check in with
year.
your doctor once a year. It's like you take your car to go get an oil change every 10,000 miles, hopefully, right? Like
Yeah.
that's the way I look at it.
Because there's a
That's the way I
number
look.
of companies like Silicon Valley startups that have kind of personalized blood work programs where you can get your blood work done twice a month. And I
Right.
almost feel like it reminds me of like when I had much more during COVID, I got on E-Trade like a lot of people and just did day trading with stocks or whatever.
Right,
And where you just
right.
like you'd be checking your E-Trade account every day and you'd see the minor fluctuations and you'd have a little mini meltdown. And then you remember it's much more about like tracking the overall aggregate performance of your portfolio. Is it similar with
Right.
blood work where you don't want to look at the small fluctuations?
Yeah, this is the thing. I always encourage patients this, right? I mean, there's certain things that have been studied. For instance, like patients will come in, oh, I have elevated inflammatory markers. But we have research studies in the past. For instance, if you talk to endocrinologists, right? When we use inflammatory markers, everything depends on the context of the situation. Now, are you stressed out? Could your inflammatory markers be high? Sure, but these are transient things. I guarantee if you check your blood 10 times a day, you're going to see different levels, right? But just like you were saying, it's all about the trend. It's all about the trend. Now, if patients come in and they're like, I need my inflammatory markers tested, well, it depends on why you need them tested. For instance, do you have rheumatoid arthritis, which is an inflammatory arthritis? And we use these inflammatory markers to help guide decision making and changing medication dosages and seeing destruction of your joints, things like that. That's one specific context, right? But if you're just like you're a healthy guy, yeah, sure, you go out to eat once or twice a week, you're sleeping about 6, 7 hours a night. Now, do you need a certain tumor marker tested? Probably not. And the big kicker here is that most of the time, what's your insurance going to cover? I mean, people can pay for whatever they want. That's quite frankly the thing. You can go get your labs directly from Quest. There's a bunch of these third-party service providers who, yeah, will come to your house and get your blood and test it and this and that. But quite frankly, I mean, you're going to need someone to at least monitor those levels and explain those in the context of the situation. That's why we always train. You don't just treat the numbers. You got to treat the patient. You got to look at what's going on. And so I just think there's been, it comes down to that corporatization of medicine. Now that there's so many of these middlemen who are like, oh, hey, they sell you on the idea of longevity, right? They sell you on the idea of anti-aging. They sell you on the idea of get your labs checked every 3 months. We're going to check your testosterone levels and this, this, and this. But it comes down to A, how is a person feeling, right? And then B, are sometimes are we doing more harm than good? Like, yes, I may feel fatigued. You may feel like the general normal 30, 40-year-old guy whose testosterone is low. And that's a big thing now, right? Because you have like these game day men's health.
Oh, yeah. Franchises. That bald guy's name is on ESPN commercials.
Yeah,
he'll make a big spiel about having more energy. And then at the end he says, and she'll like it too.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah. It's all about, I think it all comes down to selling something. But I generally tell patients, like, my niche personally is I like the older patients that have maybe probably been neglected in the past. And I kind of catch them up to speed. This is why our clinic's called Modern Medicine Group, because my thing is like, medicine's always changing. But what about those folks who are in their 60s, 70s, 80s that have been on medication and things that we know have been doing more damage, and they're maybe addicted to things like benzos and opiates? We're getting them off of these medications. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because times have changed.
For sure. And I kind of on the opposite direction of that, overusing medical services maybe is how we can couch that. There is the reality that, and this, I think this study came out of Pew just a few years ago, that only 8% of Americans get their recommended preventative screenings done in the time slot that they suggest, or the AMA or whoever suggests. So I guess from your perspective, why do you think that is? Do you think it's just people avoiding facing the harsh reality that they maybe have to make lifestyle changes? Or do you think it's a lack of knowledge that our medical societies and our government health organizations are not delivering that knowledge effectively to the broader public? What do you think it is?
I think it's a mix. I think it's a mix of numerous things. It's a mix of, I think, patient education and knowledge, and the fact that we kind of live in a reactive society. We don't really live in a proactive society, unfortunately. Now, there are those subsets of patients that are more proactive about their health. And I think it's very location specific. For instance, you're going to go to Southern California, right? You'll see a little bit more of a population that's probably more, they see their doctors probably more regularly. There's a whole concierge service type of approach there, right? Where they try to make medicine a luxury type of thing. And medicine, I think everyone needs genuine, solid healthcare. And I think that when it comes down to it, it's about being proactive about your healthcare. And yes, that's also a thing. What if, oh my gosh, there's polyps that were found on my colonoscopy? Well, yeah, I mean, because this is a thing that we're starting to see. For instance, colon cancer is starting to occur more at earlier ages for people. I personally know patients in their 30s that are developing colon cancer and passing away before they're 40. So it's an always ever-changing thing. And I think that when we focus more on lifestyle things, that's the key to solid health, is stress reduction, stress management, right? The lifestyle factors, how many people abuse alcohol and drugs and engaging in risky behavior. That's like half the battle right there. And then another thing is too, like, there's also the big component is you can't really control genetics, right? You can't really control who you're born to and what family you're born to and what kind of genes you had that maybe passed on over to you that kind of gave you a different set of cards. It's very hard to say. I can't really pinpoint on one answer, Jordan, but I would say it's a multiple of all those things. But I always encourage patients, like, that's why at least see your doctor for different things. Like, for instance, if that, hey, I'm going to have a one-time visit, schedule a wellness visit with your doctor just to go over everything, just to go over, make sure as males, for instance, like, there's a whole thing about prostate cancer, right? Colon cancer, obviously, liver cancer. But that's why we try to focus on the lifestyle stuff first. Engage, how risky are you to have this type of issue?
Yeah, let's just go ahead and jump into one topic that I made sure I wanted to cover, which is, you know, this is such a big thing right now. I'm reading this journalist, Johan Hari's book called The Magic Pill. Covers not only the background of Ozempic and these, what's the name of the hormone, GLP-1?
GLP-1.
Yeah, the hormone that gives you your sense of satiety. So tracking its history, but also he went on it himself and giving his personal experience as well. I'm worried personally about whether people are going to see it, like you said, like a fast food thing where they don't have to have the corresponding strength training and other aspects of taking this drug, and that they're just going to use it. And then we're going to get other kinds of health outcomes from it, that they might lose weight, but they might become more infirm and like have difficulties with falls or whatever it might be. What's your kind of 20,000-foot perspective on how we're using this drug and what the future is?
I think it comes down to the power of marketing, right? Marketing in any business, in any industry, that's the power of marketing. Now, semaglutide, these medications, GLP-1s, and primarily what we, when we learned about these medications and started initiating them, at least from my personal experience, like in medical school, residency, rotations, all that, when we initially jumped to these medications, what were they indicated for? They were indicated for those who were maybe diabetic, whose maybe blood sugar wasn't being adequately controlled, with the lifestyle, diet, certain medications like metformin, right? And then you kind of jump into these other avenues, right? The GLP-1s, SGLT2 receptors, antagonists, all these different mechanisms, right? Now, when it comes to that, it's not just indicated for those with diabetes. What about patients who had heart failure, coronary artery disease? All these things affect which organ, your kidney. There's plenty of way smarter people than myself and yourself that dedicate their entire life to finding out the mechanisms, finding out the pathophysiology, conducting research trials to change one step in how this process works, right? Mm-hmm. And that's what these pharmaceutical companies kind of capitalize off of. But then, in my opinion, I think this is how what happens is, then we found out, oh, it also causes weight loss too, which is, as we know, in diabetics and patients who have heart disease and kidney issues, weight loss is always a number one thing that we focus on. So it's kind of another thing where we took that side effect and now we're commercializing the side effect, and patients are just using it for just that. But little do they know that weight loss medicine is its own thing too. There's plenty of medications that have been studied for weight loss, phentermine, Topamax, all these other different medications, right? It's just that semaglutide, in my opinion, Ozempic, the marketing, the branding is more, I guess, sexier or whatever you want to call it. You know what I mean? And so to answer your question, I think that it's been around for a while, and we're going to see in the next 5 to 10 years, it's going to be huge, because people are honestly, like you said, people want the quick fix, but they don't understand and they don't look at the actions from what they're doing now to 10 years in the future. What if we find out this study is now that this medication is now causing some association with thyroid or thyroid cancer or a small bowel obstruction, things like that. But thankfully, there are continuous studies being addressed where the sample size is increasing, the power is increasing, right? They're doing more trials in different nations. Because obviously, I mean, Ozempic in Italy is going to be different than Ozempic here in Fresno or Clovis, or I mean, in California, the U.S. Because quite frankly, it comes down to our lifestyle. The average American, in my opinion, probably smokes a little bit too much, drinks a little bit too much, eats a little bit too much. And they're kind of running their bodies down into the ground a little bit. That's the average American, in my opinion. Yeah. But it's very biased.
And I think at least my conclusion I've walked away from was that there's definitely risk factors that need to be considered carefully before you start taking this.
100%.
At the same time, we know what happens when people are obese and have weight issues and all of the comorbidities that come with that. And so if you're weighing those two paths, if obviously in an ideal world, you would slowly lose some of that weight, move into a healthier place.
Sure.
But if it feels hopeless and this is the Kickstarter that's going to set you on that path, I can see why it would be a useful tool. I just think overall, the risks of obesity outweigh the risks of Ozempic. And that's just based on my kind of casual reading of the subject matter. Do you have a different perspective, or do you share my point of view?
I agree. I share your point of view there, because so for some people too, I mean, I always try to equate it like this. Like sometimes some people need that mental and emotional win to get them set on the track and change their behavior to be like, okay, yeah, maybe I should start eating healthier. Oh, I know I've dropped a couple pounds. I can do this. It's all about building momentum. And I think that's just throughout life in general, I think when we look at health, it's not just a physical component. It's not mental. It's not just mental. It's not, there's a mental, there's a spiritual component, there's an emotional component, and then there's a physical component. And I think that a healthy individual, you have to look at all these things. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
And so I think that if patients need a certain win, A, is it medically indicated? Because quite frankly, too, you could put anybody on any medication, they can have side effects and have issues, and then the blame comes down to you, right? The blame comes down to, oh, wait, what, you knowing your background, your training, and you know that you put this patient on this medication and that they didn't really meet indications for it. Why would you do that? You know what I mean? And then the other argument's like, well, I'm trying to at least instill some hope for this patient. And maybe we could focus on some way to build them that momentum, get that step in a little bit, you know?
Yeah.
So Yeah.
We're going to jump into my favorite section now, which is called overrated versus underrated. I'm going to give you a bunch of things. You tell me whether you think they're over or underrated and why.
Sure.
So the first one, hospital food.
Depends on the hospital. It's underrated depending on the hospital.
Okay, where's the best hospital food you've ever had?
Oh man, I was a med student. I think we had actually our residency, they didn't have really that bad of a menu. Everything was kind of covered in our stipend, so I couldn't complain. But I heard from some close friends, I think like UCLA, there's some, I think it was at the Santa Monica hospital.
They apparently have good food.
they had a really, really nice cafe.
All right. Next one. Andrew Huberman's podcast.
Yeah,
is it over or underrated from your perspective as a physician?
Yeah. As a physician, I think that it's underrated. I generally do enjoy his content. There is some concern, I think, because there now it's becoming a little bit more of a salesman-y type of approach where, yes, I'm marketing these products that I'm probably involved in and this and that. And so that's always that component that always bothers me, because as a physician, as a doctor, I think he teaches at med schools too, and he has a background in it. It's like, okay, well, what are you going to kind of getting paid under the table to promote whatever message you want to promote? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
No, that's where my only...
The whole supplement sales game is always... Yeah, it makes me a little bit nervous too. And that's kind of my next one. Do you think athletic greens are over or underrated?
I need to look more into it. I'm going to be 100% honest with you. It's something that's literally on my to-do list of like reading material. Yeah. I have a list of probably like 750 like topics, like one-liners of things I need to like look into.
Yeah, it's interesting because I do not athletic greens, but kind of like the Sprouts equivalent of it every morning. And I don't know, I've read conflicting things, like it's always good to add some additional vitamins and minerals to your diet, but how do you draw any kind of causal links to any health improvements is kind of vague. Next one, fitness trackers. Do you think they're worth, because I pay attention to mine probably more than I should.
Yeah.
Like the stupid rings closing every day. As a doctor, you think those things are over or underrated?
I think they're overrated. I think they're overrated in the sense, only the sense, because like you were saying, when you know that you should walk a certain amount or exercise a certain amount, I don't want patients to become super fixated on it. Now that's where it becomes to like that, I guess you want to call it maybe a mental training or what's that term that they use in psychology? You're essentially kind of training that association, right? I need to close these rings. As long as it doesn't become an obsession and like a compulsive type of thing, I'm all for it. I just feel that listen to your body rather than listening to a tracker.
Yeah, you're right about the Pavlov aspect of it, you know?
Yes.
The salivating dogs. I used to be this way. I'm not this way anymore, but there would be some nights where it'd be like 9:30 and like I have a few more steps and I'm like suddenly doing dishes. I'm walking up and down the stairs to do laundry. Like I'm like moving around stuff in the backyard and my wife is like, what the hell are you doing? I'm like, I got to meet my move goal. And I think that was,
I got to close the circle, damn it.
I think that was kind of COVID related, just being stuck indoors and then feeling like you needed to be hitting some kind of marker of like, I'm making progress in my life. Okay.
Yeah.
Anyway, next one, the Affordable Care Act.
Oh, the Affordable Care Act. Man, I'm going to be 100% honest with you, Jordan. I think that when it comes down to how it was initiated and making it a mandatory requirement for everybody to have insurance, I I think that insurance companies, in my opinion, they kind of interfere a lot. They
Yeah, they're
interfere a
very
lot.
smart. They know what they're doing. They're
They know what
smart.
they're doing, right? And so I don't know. I don't know enough to generally say whether it's overrated or underrated. I generally feel that everyone should have access to quality healthcare. I feel that everybody should have their medical needs taken care of. But the fact of making it mandatory for everybody and all that, maybe it's a ploy for them to at least get people into a doctor and at least get some sort of checkup. Maybe their intentions were probably good in the initial state of that. But to be quite honest, I was probably a little bit too young to really understand it. And then throughout medical school and training, until opening up my own practice was not when I started learning more about insurance and how the insurance game works and what's an HMO, what's a PPO, why do you have to, quite frankly, I just look at it as like another middleman, but it's a necessary evil because I don't want to say evil. Don't get me wrong. I don't want to try to paint the negative picture out there. I think insurance is great. But I think that there's a huge change coming. I think that patients should definitely have insurance for emergencies. They shouldn't be having like the low deductible plans, and then you're paying someone $3,000, $4,000 a month for a family, and you know that you're generally healthy. Now, that also comes down to personal accountability. If you have more health problems, then yeah, you probably need an adjustment of your insurance coverage.
Yeah, it seems complicated, and I mean, it is obviously complicated. And I read a number of books about it, trying to understand both how insurance companies game the system, kind of what its ripple effects were. I don't know. We're seeing right now, with at least in California, with like fire insurance and homeowner insurance, and like State Farm's not taking new policies, and maybe that's kind of, it's a different kind of insurance, but largely the same issue, which is that things are getting so expensive. At a certain point, insurance companies are just going to get out of the business of insuring because it's just too complicated.
Probably.
And then, like you said, what's next? And I don't know. We could go down that rabbit hole for an hour, so let's not do that.
I know, right?
Next one, we'll do an easy one. Next one, me and Ed's Pizza.
Oh my gosh. Me and Ned's is It's underrated, man. Me and Ed's is a it's a classic pizza franchise here in the Valley. I generally do feel that their ingredients have probably changed. Their quality's changed a lot since 10 years ago. For sure. For sure. And I'm gonna be 100% honest with you. It's been a while since I've had Me and Ed's. Like at least 15 years.
So the next one involves a little bit of a story. So last summer I went to Maui for a vacation, and we stayed not in a resort, but kind of an Airbnb off the resort area. But at some point I wanted to sneak in, or just go into, where they filmed the TV show White Lotus, which was this kind of hilarious satire on wealthy people at resorts. And I was within walking distance of our Airbnb, so I walked on. They had the cucumber water in the lobby and whatever else. And but what was funny to me was I walked down kind of close to the beach area, and there was a little sign that said, it had a QR code on the front. You could scan it, and then you could get someone to come down to the beach with an IV bag of stem cells to get stem cell therapy on the beach while you like sunbathe. Do you think that's
What?
over underrated?
What the hell? I think that's overrated. I think a lot of that stuff, a lot of it is, it's experimental stuff. I mean, this is the thing. In medicine, there has to be an indication. Even here, you're going to have these IV salons, right? These IV places you're feeling dehydrated, you're feeling thirsty, you had a hangover, come get an IV, you're going to spend $400. They don't tell you that those vitamins that they're giving you, they're all water-soluble vitamins, which means that you pee all of it out in 2 to 3 hours. So quite frankly, save yourself the $300, $400. A lot of people are not going to like me saying this because it's a business at the end of the day.
Yeah.
And I think placebo effect is a big thing. Now
Yeah.
it's different. In the hospital, people's favorite argument, oh, but in the hospital, they give IVs all the time. Yeah, because when patients show up to the hospital, they're probably confused, disoriented. Their blood pressure is probably low. They're probably nauseous and vomiting. They can't keep anything oral down. Those are quite frankly the only really indications that I would see of someone putting an IV into your vein. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah,
It
yeah, yeah.
shouldn't be just a thing for vanity and post it on my Instagram and be like, oh, look, we're getting IV vitamin therapy. We're so cool. Like,
I did
cool.
kind of want to get some stem cell therapy on the beach
Give
just to say I did it as kind of a bucket list item.
it a try. Let me know how it works out. We'll look into it together.
Yeah, it was. I mean, it's kind of morbid. You know, you're on a beach, you're supposed to be on vacation, and then you have like an IV bag. You're like, what is happening here?
Well, once again, last marketing.
Last one on this overrated versus underrated. Yeah. This was one that I have personal involvement with. Extreme heat and cold exposure, also known as saunas, cold plunges, cryo. Are those things over or underrated for people's health?
I think they're underrated. I'm personally looking more into that too. I think that the science makes sense to me because there's this whole concept of elevating like your heat shock proteins, right? And the second, third party effects that has in your chemical messenger system and all that, right? And complements and factors and inflammatory cascade, right? And all these different things, like the science is there. It makes sense. I'm more excited to see what happens in the next 5 to 10 years, right? I think that, I mean, it personally does make sense to me. I think if you put yourself in a stressful environment, give yourself that, your body, that ability to adapt and change, it will probably change, right? At the end of the day, we're still cellular organisms. Mm-hmm. So it's underrated in my opinion. I always encourage patients to do it. I mean, patients are very stressed out. Patients are anxious. And I personally like to do 40, 50 minutes at a time in the sauna. When I go to the gym, do my cardio, do my lifting, and then get the sauna for 30, 40 minutes, get a good sweat, feel tired. And I sleep better. I feel better. I feel like I mentate better. So maybe call it placebo, call it whatever, but I think it's helpful.
Yeah, that was my big purchase during COVID. Is I bought a little sauna that's in our closet. It's like 5 feet tall, and so you got to kind of crouch to get in, but it fits one person snugly. And if I do it at night, right before bed, it knocks me out. Like the idea that you're decreasing your body temperature, you're cooling your body down, and then you can slide into your bed. Oof, yeah, there's really nothing like
that. Yeah. No, that's awesome.
Yeah, let's jump into a few policy questions before we wrap up. I work in Madera, and over the last few years, we've been dealing with the ramifications of the hospital closing. And hospitals are obviously complicated. I don't know if you want to call them businesses, complicated organizations. And there has been kind of a spate of rural hospitals closing across the country. Do you see the future moving away from large agglomerations of various medical services to more kind of smaller, fragmented medical services and independent groups and with a couple large regional hospitals? Or do you think hospitals are just going to always be a major part of our medical system?
I think hospitals will probably always be a major part because you still need somewhere to go in emergent settings, right? And then obviously here in the U.S., I mean, everything comes down to your policies and your licensing. And whereas you go to a village in India, it's like a hospital could just be makeshift, right?
Yeah.
You go to these different countries. So clinics. I think a lot of the stuff that holds it back is, like you're saying, whether it's a business or organization, quite frankly, I think everything in America and the U.S. is a business. But it all comes down to what's money coming in, what's money coming out. And then quite frankly, I think there's a lot of mismanagement at hospitals too. And quite frankly, in corporate medicine, once again, people probably aren't going to like it, but there's a whole administrative component. When you look at the amount of money that we spend on medical administration, it's only gone up. People think that it's the doctors and nurses that, that make the most money. I tell them, look, man, if you see my tax returns, you're not going to be like, oh, wow, like he went through all this schooling to be like, I say all that to say that there's a misallocation of funds, in my opinion, you know? And so how much a hospital makes in Madera, quite frankly, I think it comes down to management. In any business, it comes down to how well you manage your staffing and obviously avoiding lawsuits and avoiding waste. But some of those things are not, I'm not too well versed in those to give a genuine opinion on. But I think that the future is different. I think the future is kind of transitioning more to, if you're sicker and you have more health conditions, you're going to need a little bit more careful monitoring and care. If you're healthy, great. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But we'll see it.
Another thing that's a major topic of interest and concern in the Valley is obviously the number of dispensaries are increasing. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of delivery services for people to buy weed at home. And I'm curious your perspective as a physician. I forget where I heard this. And so I hate to do hearsay statistics, but it was something like, there's a large proportion of the people that use marijuana in the United States use it daily.
Yeah.
And I've been following pretty closely what's been going on in Oregon with decriminalization of drugs and some of the outcomes of that. And obviously, wide-scale decriminalization of everything is different than having a very well-regulated dispensary system.
Yeah.
But I think they're broaching the same subject, which is how do we ensure that people can do this safely, but also not encouraging major health problems as a society by making it easy access. So it seems complicated. Yeah. What's your perspective?
I agree. I think that kind of times have changed a lot, right? As cannabis, I think that it has its medical indications. I mean, for instance, there's medication like dronabinol is a medication that we've used for like chemotherapy induced nausea and vomiting, right? Quite frankly, I think it also comes down, once again, it comes like your lobbying power and all that. And I think that, quite frankly, like the business side of me says that obviously the government probably wants in on it, you know? I generally do feel that it needs to be monitored. These things are not benign, per se. Now, I can say that it comes down to apples and oranges. Like, would I rather have a patient who is going to use marijuana or use alcohol? Quite frankly, I'll just keep it at this because I don't want to medically recommend one or the other. Yeah. I haven't really seen a person die from marijuana use compared to the amount of people I've seen go through withdrawal and seizures and cirrhosis and liver failure with alcohol. You know what I mean? Now, can you become addicted to anything? Yeah. Addiction medicine is a big passion of mine. I like to practice and work with patients in that, these types of realms. But I would say we need more studies to show us what dose works for what. Like, for instance, there's patients saying, oh, I smoke to help with my anxiety. But okay, but there's different strands that may elevate your energy levels, right? There's different strands that are probably used for different ways, like for helping you sleep, helping you with appetite. I think it comes down again to how do we use those side effects and then medically integrate those. Do you know what I mean?
Let's imagine I made you the medical czar of Fresno County. you had this job for a week and you could make some changes to either our medical delivery system or something environmental about Fresno to improve health outcomes. Where might you start on your 1 week in power?
Man, I'd probably start with garnering good relationships between clinics and hospitals and trying to avoid big corporate takeovers, because quite frankly, I mean, the big corporate guys are just going to look at you kind of like a cog in the wheel, right? And I think it's about developing good referral networks and good relationships and outreach with patients. People don't know that you're open or know that you're there, then it kind of does, it leads to more suffering for them. But specifically, I would probably focus more on garnering those relationships with hospitals, referral sources, getting the name out for clinics. And then obviously, like, if I had the wherewithal, have an actual full legit medical compound so that it's more easier for patients, have a division that is taking care of patients at a distance and things like that. I have a whole bunch of ideas. I would love to incorporate that maybe one day in the next 10 to 15, 20 years if I get there. But I think that there's just so much inefficiency in the system that that's what we need to focus on. It's inefficiency in medication reconciliation, inefficiency in patient care, inefficiency of how a patient even gets into your office in the first place. There's so many different levels to it, which is why I'm finally seeing that every day I'm trying to work on something to try to eliminate that, at least from my small clinic perspective.
And let's say, as a next hypothetical, the city council called you and they wanted you to brief them on some of the biggest environmental factors that lead to negative health outcomes. Yeah. What are one or two that you might point to that the city government should focus on alleviating or improving?
Yeah, I think especially in our area, I mean, a lot of it will probably come down to air quality is always a big one. I mean, with asthma and strict lung diseases that we see here in the valley and allergies and things like that, right? I think another big thing would also be, I'd probably say especially here in the Fresno area, it's changed a lot, Jordan, over the last 10, 15 years than what I was used to. A lot more chronic care illnesses, a lot more of the elderly out here now. I think that they need a little bit more specialized attention rather than being brushed off. And I think that needs to be approached to help with getting patients an appointment. I mean, here, we do have a lot of like Calviva and Medi-Cal and things like that. And there are certain agencies that are focusing on getting them care. But quite frankly, there's also I mean, gosh, there's what, 500, 600,000 people in Fresno County that are accounted for. I think the last time I heard it was somewhere around like 900, almost about to break a million, right, in terms of people. But to answer your question, long story short, I'd probably say that it comes down to attracting those patients and finding them a clinic and doctor that they genuinely like, rather than just treating it like fast but quick medicine. Give me my medication, I'm out of here. And then mental health is another big thing too, and addiction medicine, fentanyl, meth use, alcohol use,
Yeah, there's a lot of issues we have.
100%.
I always ask everyone the same question kind of towards the end of our conversations, and it's about how you see a place. I think what we choose to do in our work lives influences how we see where we live. So I work in education, and so I tend to look at the world through education problems and education solutions. Even when it comes to something like medicine, where I'm like, oh, how can we inform people better about what they need to do? How does being a physician living and working in Fresno affected the way you see Fresno?
Man, Fresno's always been home to me, so I love it. For me, it's more of a pride thing. It's more of like I get to come back to my home. This is my home. Our family's been here for 20 plus years, right? And so it's amazing to me when I get to see new patients at my clinic. I always ask them, where are you from? Where are you born and raised? Are you from here? Oh, so then you've seen all the development. And quite frankly, I mean, Fresno has a we have that kind of bad habit where a lot of our kids in our school, they leave the school, they go to the down south, that they go out of state or whatever. And they never end up coming back. And I would probably say I'm one of the few out of my own group or circle that ended up leaving and ended up coming back.
Yeah, the brain
But
drain
for
is a
me, it's a
real
pride
thing.
thing. Yeah.
Yeah,
Yeah. The brain
absolutely.
drain. Exactly. Exactly. And so, yeah, I'm proud. I love to be back in the Valley. The Valley is my home, not going anywhere.
Yes.
You know?
Okay. We're going to close with two questions.
Yes,
First is
sir.
a few books you'd recommend to listeners. And then the
Yeah.
second is I would love to hear more about your new practice and what kinds of things and services that you offer there.
No, of course, I appreciate it. The two books I'm actually currently working on right now. I got done with Being Mortal by Atul Gawande. He's like an
I was
American
actually going to
surgeon.
bring him up earlier. I didn't, but
Really?
do you like his work?
I got through that book. I've read it probably two or three times now because I read it before med school, after med school, and then recently I just finished the like third pass through it. And it's a good book. It's a great book because it changes you, teaches you about perspective of like being a patient, right? And yes, we lived it and we worked it, but seeing it from his perspective of how his family dealt with it, how his dad dealt with it, that's an eye-opener for me.
For sure.
The other one is Ray Dalio. He has a really good book, Changing World Order, I think. And it's kind of delving a little bit more into the financial and global market of the United States and how we fit into where we were. Like at one point, we were an empire, right? And all these different nations, the history of certain nations, how they rise, how they fail, how they're growing. What's the biggest concern? I really recently just got into that. So that's something I'm currently working on. And then the rest of the time, I'm probably reading up on some journals or whatever the new study is. So going through those 700 topics I have in my
Yeah,
notes.
absolutely. And then
But
can you
yeah.
tell us a little bit about your practice?
Yeah, no, of course. My practice is called called the Modern Medicine Group. It's a primary care clinic. Primarily, it's both me and my wife, Dr. Carr. She's going to be joining us actually in a couple months. We're both board certified internal medicine doctors. Our big approach was that when we jumped into the clinic, we just wanted to be able to take our time with patients. And we didn't want to feel like a cog in the wheel and have some administrator telling us, oh, you have to see 15, 25, 35 patients today, and you only get to spend 5 minutes with them. We're trying to build relationships with patients, right? We're trying to help them, empower them, and take our time and practice the medicine that we wanted to practice. And quite frankly, it's growing slowly. It's taking time, but I like that. Slow growth is better than no growth, and it gives me time to focus on patients and make sure they get seen for the right things. And we're taking patients off of medications, and I get to spend more time counseling them, educating them. I feel like I'm making good changes. So, yeah. So, if anybody's looking for a new primary care doctor, definitely reach out.
Well, I really appreciate you taking the time. This dealing with medical stuff, health and wellness stuff can feel so complicated because there's so much noise in this space. And so having really clear conversations about complicated subjects can be so refreshing and helpful. So I appreciate you taking the time to kind of help me sift through some things that I was curious about. And I know the listeners are going to really value what you've offered to them today and getting them different ways to think about these subjects that are maybe a little more level-headed and clear. So I appreciate you taking the time.
No, I appreciate you helping me with this opportunity and being able to speak to you and using your platform too. Really appreciate your time, Jordan. It was a pleasure. Pleasure.
Thanks for listening, everyone. As always, you can support this podcast by leaving us a rating or review or by making a financial contribution at our Patreon page, which is www.patreon.com/Fresno's Best. We'll see you next time.